Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Welcome to The Paranoid Strain. This is an episode in the middle of our long-term, multi-part examination of the history, philosophy, and implications of human interactions with non-human intelligence. We call it unidentified because we're fancy, but you can think of it as our big UFO series. If this is your first ever episode, you might want to skip back to the first unidentified episode to get the whole story. Please note that some of the voices, especially the celebrities, that you hear in our show are generated by AI because it makes our book excerpts and other quotes more interesting. Rest assured that Fearful, Dana, and our interviewees are always real humans and that we'll never cut that corner, now or in the future. Returning Strainiacs, we have a few requests. First, please email us at theparanoidstrain@gmail.com with feedback. We love it. If you use Facebook, please look up and join our friendly and active group. We set up a YouTube channel, mostly to help people find the podcast, but if you could subscribe, ring the bell, and play a couple of episodes in the background, that will help us show up in the algorithm and swell our unholy ranks. Finally, anyone who wants to go that extra mile is invited to join our Patreon at patreon.com/theparanoidstrain. If you subscribe at the $5 tier, I will eventually mention you in one of these intros and embroil you in an imaginary conspiracy theory, as I'm about to do for Shane, who's also known as Q. Given our previous series, I assume you're thinking he's behind the all-encompassing conspiracy that threatens our democracy. But you're wrong. He's actually the guy who provides Britain's most famous secret agent with all of that wonderful technology. Since Brexit, though, there have been cutbacks in the department. So his latest brainchild is a new business card that reads, "I, James Bond, am not a spy. So, like, chill, please." Thanks to all of you patrons for supporting us directly, and to all the rest of you for listening and sharing. It means the world to us. Now, let's get this show on the road. Paranoid Strain Orchestra, hit it. After Moritz's total failure to show anyone these legendary books, a 1976 joint British and Ecuadorian mission set out to map this cave system, with at least some of the group's backers hoping that said mapping effort would eventually lead to the discovery of the legendary library. This expedition was notable for being far more rigorous than previous efforts, involving dozens of people, a camera crew, and representatives of both countries' militaries.
Oh, and the first man to step on the fucking moon?
Yeah. Neil goddamned Armstrong was somehow convinced to be the figurehead leader of this mission in order to drum up public interest. He even visited the site and actually went spelunking under the guidance of some of the expert cavers in attendance. Why exactly Armstrong decided to put his name on this venture was not something the famously taciturn former astronaut ever revealed publicly. But of course, that doesn't prevent ancient aliens conspiracists from alleging that a completely unrelated speech he gave in 1994 was his cryptic reference to the 1976 expedition, which of course did not turn up a golden library.
But then, in 1994 at the White House, 20 years after his quest to find the ancient metal library, Armstrong gives a strangely worded speech.
"We have only completed a beginning. We leave you much that is undone. There are great ideas undiscovered, breakthroughs available to those who can remove one of truth's protective layers."
That's a very tantalizing quote from Neil Armstrong. almost mystical in its nature, how he talks about uncovering the layers to some hidden truths. What did he mean by that? Could this library hold the secrets of the galaxy? Is that why Neil Armstrong went on this expedition?
If you think that speech is actually about the future of humanity's exploration of space and not the cockamamie nonsense that Lady suggested, join the club.
Coppin's chapter on this topic continues at some length, regaling his readers with the real story of the real discoverer of the real cave, who turns out not to be that untrustworthy Morich guy, but a different, much more trustworthy dude, and that guy's dad, both of whom are unfortunately dead now, and how the library is not in the Cueva de los Tayos, but rather a different place, and how believers would totally have found the library and proven the skeptics wrong by now, if not for a variety of geopolitical and other factors that have gotten in the way over the decades.
Also, they all totally have girlfriends, but they go to a different school.
Okay, so the metal library was a bust. But what about the very clear and indubitable evidence that the Dogon tribe of Mali, in Africa, learned the secrets of the stars from little green men?
The story that the Dogon, a tribe in Mali, West Africa, had possessed in their antiquity extraordinary knowledge of the star system Sirius achieved worldwide publicity in 1976 through Robert Temple's extraordinary book, The Sirius Mystery. It was compellingly argued and became one of the most influential books of the 1970s ancient astronauts genre. Apart from apparently possessing astronomical knowledge about the four moons of Jupiter and rings of Saturn, which the modern world only discovered with the help of the telescope, Temple claimed that the Dogon specifically knew about two smaller stars that are closely related to Sirius, Sirius B and Sirius C. The mystery was how they had obtained this astronomical knowledge, as these companion stars cannot be seen by the unaided eye. He argued that the knowledge the Dogon possessed of Sirius could only have been given to them by extraterrestrial beings that possessed information on that star system. As the star Sirius was also the brightest star in the sky, and hence the most important star for the ancient Egyptians, who based their calendar on it, the obvious follow-up question was whether the ancient Egyptians and the Dogon of Mali were somehow related and or had somehow shared this very specific knowledge about Sirius. Temple concluded that the answer was positive.
Far be it from me to suggest that I am an expert. But the one thing I know for certain about the Dogons is that theirs is the third worst poetry in the universe, the second worst being that of the Asgos of Crea. During a recitation by their
Straniacs? No. Fearful Jesuit is not having a stroke. Instead, he's reciting a short passage from the brilliantly funny classic novel The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy by Douglas Adams. He's doing this for two main reasons. The first and most important is that he is proudly reciting this completely from his eighth grade memory, and that when he double-checked his work, it was so close to the original that he deliberately left in the few small mistakes he had made, because he felt they only highlighted his, and I'm quoting here, astounding feat of recall. And as many of you probably already know, this passage originally referenced the Vogons, an unpleasant bureaucratic race of aliens in the book, and that name rhymes quite nicely with the Dogons we're actually discussing. So he thought that reciting this and pretending he had made a silly mistake would be hilarious and ignored all sensible suggestions otherwise. Okay, I think it's over. Please pretend you're impressed.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Thank you. No, thank you. Hey, sorry about that, guys. I meant Dogons, not Vogons. Oh, I'm so glad we all got to share that wonderful, totally warranted riff that definitely didn't waste anyone's time.
Email all complaints to theparanoidstrain@gmail.com.
Yeah, we have fun. But back to the Dogons and their supposed star knowledge, which can apparently only be explained via direct contact with an alien intelligence. As Mr. Coppins just discussed, this whole idea is based on a single book. The author of that book, in turn, interpreted the work of two French ethnographers, Germain Dieterlin and Marcel Creole. Now, unlike the author who made their work famous, Griol and Dieterlin appear to have been conscientious scientists who took their work exploring the culture of the Dogon peoples of Mali seriously. Dieterlin, for example, spent nearly 2 decades with the tribe and did good work. And it's absolutely true that Griol claimed to have been initiated into the tribe's sacred mysteries, where he learned details of their thought that implied, to him at least, that the Dogons had long known about Sirius's companion star, the story that Temple eventually elaborated in his 1976 book. There are at least a couple of issues here. The first job, as always, is to figure out whether Griol's, and eventually Temple's, interpretation matches up with what other researchers have learned about the Dogon people. Secondly, assuming that these stories seem consistent, we need to figure out whether they were there in the first place in Dogon mythology, or if instead there might have been some inadvertent knowledge transfer between the scientist and the people whom he studied. Let's take the second part first, where the news is not great for believers in the serious mystery. There is, as it turns out, plenty of reason to doubt the conclusions of Monsieur Griol about the Dogon's knowledge of Sirius as a binary.
Actually, as it turns out, a ternary, because astronomers have discovered that the system consists of Sirius A, B, and C.
Fair enough. There's reason to believe that Griol, almost certainly unintentionally, may have transferred his knowledge of the then-recent astronomical discoveries related to Sirius to his Dogon interview subjects after he learned Sirius played an important role in the group's worldview and native religious practices. And it's hardly surprising that a technologically unsophisticated group would still incorporate the star Sirius into their description of the world, since it's the brightest star visible in the sky, and easily seen with the naked eye. A 1996 article in the Skeptical Inquirer,
again, thanks Patreon patrons for that subscription,
points out that conversely, it's literally physically impossible for anyone to distinguish the two stars using just their eyes, because they appear too close together for even the sharpest human vision to distinguish their images. So unless you accept Taylor's "the ET told them" explanation,
which, to be clear, Griol and Dieterlin did not,
the idea that the Dogons knew the details of this star system before they were contacted by outsiders is a non-starter, for purely physical reasons. But to make things worse, the article goes on to note that many researchers don't think that Sirius is even an important part of the group's rituals, pointing out that the sun and moon are far more central.
As one might expect, given how large they loom in Earth's sky.
In addition, a major 1991 expedition to the Dogon, headed by anthropologist Walter Van Beek, found no trace of the Sirius story that Griol had documented among any Dogon person he interviewed. Further, even the minority of researchers who were in agreement with Griol's interpretation of the centrality of Sirius to the Dogon's cosmology don't believe they referred to the star's binary partner in their stories, but rather that the tribe's people refer to stars that are close to Sirius, but distinguishable from it in the night sky.
Okay, so to briefly review, a 1976 book suggested that a tribe in Africa was contacted by aliens. And the proof is the work of an ethnographer in the 1950s who himself didn't buy the alien theory. But colleagues questioned this researcher's conclusions about the importance of the star Sirius to the Dogons. And even if you accept those conclusions, it's more reasonable to conclude they were talking about a different star that you can see with the naked eye. This is somehow even worse supported than the average ancient aliens nonsense.
True. Which is probably why even Coppens takes this opportunity to employ his inconsistent and insufficient sense of skepticism to drop the hammer on Taylor and his book.
With this, the Dogon mystery and the possibility of alien contact with a tribe in Central Africa comes crashing down. For more than 20 years, the Sirius mystery influenced speculation about the possibility that our forefathers came from the stars. In his 1998 revised edition, Temple was quick to point out the new discussions in scientific circles about the possible existence of Sirius C, which seemed to make Griol's claims even more spectacular and accurate. But it is apparent that Temple was either not aware of Van Beek's devastating research, or he decided to ignore it.
We've now covered a wide range of ancient aliens theories, but we're yet to touch on one of the biggest, most influential ideas and figures in the movement. So now we're going to thoroughly explore the fascinating and completely batshit ideas of Zechariah Sitchin.
And as a special bonus, we're very pleased to introduce our first expert interview of this young series, a charming academic and Sitchin debunker who will now introduce himself.
Hello, I'm David Miano. I am a historian of ancient times. I PhD in ancient history. I went to UC San Diego for that. And more recently, I have a YouTube channel called World of Antiquity, in which I make educational videos about ancient history. And one of the things I'm known for on the channel is addressing a lot of pseudo-historical, pseudo-scientific claims about ancient history.
So we have our mainstream expert in one corner, but every fight requires at least two combatants, so we should probably provide a brief biographical sketch of our ancient alien enthusiast as well. As Mr. Sitchin is no longer counted among the living, we will task also deceased New Age guru Elizabeth Clare Prophet with our introduction, as delivered in her 1986 interview.
Welcome to Summit University Forum, where the flame of freedom speaks. Today our guest is Zechariah Sitchin. He was born in Russia and raised in Palestine, where he acquired a profound knowledge of modern and ancient Hebrew and other Semitic and European languages, the Old Testament, the history of archaeology of the Near East. Mr. Sitchin attended the London School of Economics, was graduated from the University of London, majoring in economic history. A leading journalist and editor in Israel for many years, he now lives and writes in New York. In 1976, Mr. Sitchin published the first of his Earth Chronicles series, The 12th Planet, a revolutionary work which made a case for the existence of another planet in our solar system, whose astronauts have been visiting the Earth for 450,000 years. It was followed in 1980 by The Stairway to Heaven, and in June of this year, he published The Wars of Gods and Men, a startling work that provides evidence that the wars of men began with the wars of the gods, wars for the control of this Earth, which began on their own planet and led to a nuclear holocaust in the Middle East 4,000 years ago. Zechariah Sitchin, welcome to Summit University Forum. Thank you for being our guest
today. Thank you, Elizabeth, for having me. I've been waiting a long time to be invited.
To synopsize, Sitchin was a self-taught hobbyist who, when not working his day job as a shipping executive, researched and wrote about topics that meant a lot to him, while also being, by all accounts, a loving husband and father.
That sounds a lot like your bio, doesn't it, Jesuit?
Well, I'm not in the shipping game, but trust me, I see the parallels. As a self-anointed disseminator of truth as I see it, I recognize that Sitchin and I are pretty equally unqualified to declaim on these topics academically. Which is precisely why I'm not setting myself up as the debunker of Sitchin's enthusiastic, presumably well-intentioned, and completely baseless ideas. That's Dr. Miano's job. Before we kick off the vivisection of his magnum opus, I want to note that Sitchin seems like a pretty good guy. I'm sympathetic to him in a way that I'm not toward von Daniken. The latter strikes me as having an almost monstrous lack of concern with consistency, coherence, or even the appearance of rigor, paired with an ego the size of the sun. Sitchin, on the other hand, appears the kind of guy who, relatively innocently, gets so excited about what he's learned that he wants to make the story grander, more all-encompassing, better than the facts actually support. And while most of what he says is going to demolish Sitchin's arguments into their component parts, Dr. Miano, too, admits to a soft spot for the old kook.
Yeah, I think there's some truth in that. Sitchin just really enjoys the subject and loves to speculate about it and weave together a tale, not as much to make a name for himself as to just tell people about the cool things he found or something like that. Whereas Eric von Daniken probably is trying to like herald himself as some kind of genius.
Still not convinced? How about these excerpts from a New York Times slice of life piece about the man, written in early 2010 when Sitchin was 90.
Born in Russia and raised in Israel, Mr. Sitchin studied economics in London and worked as a journalist and editor in Israel before moving to New York in 1952. Here, he was an executive at a shipping company and, with his wife of 66 years, she died in 2007, raised two daughters. He spent his free time studying, leading archaeological tours to ancient sites and spreading his unusual gospel.
Regarding this gospel, he goes on.
Outlandish, yes, but also somehow intriguing from this cute, distinguished old man whom you may have seen shuffling slowly down Broadway with his cane and thought, is Art Carney still alive?
And you have to admit, the guy knew how to enjoy his golden years.
The Upper West Side is Mr. Sitchin's Mesopotamia, Broadway a fertile valley. He has Lincoln Center, Zabar's, Fairway, dry cleaners that deliver in a galaxy of takeout restaurants. For research, the New York Public Library is down on 42nd Street, and the archives of the Jewish Theological Seminary up on Broadway at 122nd Street.
All of this is just to say that I find Sitchin's whole demeanor, lifestyle, sincerity, and attitude head and shoulders over his chief rival in the ancient aliens field, the fraudster, felon, self-promoter, Von Daniken. But of course, Sitchin's ending up a super cute old guy living the dream in Manhattan doesn't make any of his bizarre conjectures any more likely.
And what exactly are those conjectures?
Strap in. Much like Von Daniken, a lot of Sitchin's theories are centered around the region of Mesopotamia, which we've all heard referred to as the cradle of civilization. But wait, why am I trying to talk to you about this stuff? That's why we have Dr. Miano.
When we talk about ancient times, well, history begins with writing. So that's kind of when it begins. So that would be in the fourth millennium BCE. Everything before that we call prehistory. However, a lot of the people that I have to address, they talk a lot about prehistory and advanced lost civilizations and the Stone Age and things like that. So I do have to deal with that. Technically, ancient history begins after 4000 BCE. And then it ends like 600 CE with the fall of Rome and all of that. So if we go back to the dawn of civilization, so to speak, the consensus among the experts is, and this is mainly from archaeology, our earliest evidence of cities is in Mesopotamia. So everyone's heard of the Sumerians, right? That is the generally considered the first complex society, first states, the first cities in the world. And the city of Uruk is generally thought of as the first city. The first cities in the world were in southern Mesopotamia, and that's where the Sumerians were. So you hear a lot of people talk about the Sumerians because, oh, they're the first, you know, they invented all this and that. They did appear to have invented bronze and the wheel and their first writing and all of that. Following them is another people who formed an empire, the first empire in the world. That's the Akkadian Empire. The Sumerians and the Akkadians lived near each other, but they spoke two different languages, but they shared a lot of the same culture. As a matter of fact, they both used cuneiform to write things. You could use cuneiform to write any language you want. You can use it to write English. But the Sumerians used it first. The Akkadian people used it afterward, not long afterward. They all go by the wayside. Mesopotamia then starts forming other empires. You have Babylonians. You have Assyrians. Generally speaking, just to remember, Babylonians, they were in the southern part of Mesopotamia, and Assyrians were in the northern part. Not to be confused with Syrians without the A. That's over in where we now think of Assyria. We're talking about Assyrians, which is in northern Iraq.
And here we find Sitchin's first stumbling block. His lack of formal education in the subject, combined with his enthusiasm and not particularly rigorous style, means he tends to elide and combine the Sumerian, Babylonian, and other cultures' myths and history into a sort of Chex Mix from which he carefully selects only the pieces he likes, pretending as if all of these texts, ideas, and cultures are totally interchangeable.
When we talk about a lot of these places, especially people who are amateurs, who are interested in the beginnings of civilization, all that, they lump them all together. And they just think, oh, they're all the same. They're all Sumerians, or they're all Babylonians, or something like that. But they were different cultures. There were different languages spoken. But they all lived in the same area, and so there's going to be influence down. But condensing them all kind of into a single society or something like that is not really taking into account the long span of time that people lived in Mesopotamia in ancient times.
Yes, he's referring to Sitchin when he talks about amateurs. He's just very nice about it.
Now we know the actual history of the peoples upon whose culture and texts Sitchin would create his theories. But what are those theories? The best synopsis I was able to find doesn't actually mention Sitchin in the video itself, but provides a version of the theory that's pretty Sitchin compliant. So here goes.
The Anunnaki live on the planet Nibiru, which orbits our system. They are an ancient race of extremely developed and powerful beings, and can be considered gods in human eyes. But even the great Anunnaki suffered from the terrible environmental conditions on their planet. A large crack had formed in Nibiru's ozone layer. This crack widened every decade, increasing global warming and destroying crops and animal life. The Anunnaki discovered that pouring gold dust particles into the atmosphere slowed down the expansion of the crack, even reversing it slightly. But Nibiru was a mineral-poor planet, and gold was extremely scarce. The lack of food quickly led to revolt among the population. Anu was chosen as the new king of Nibiru. Anu realized that the only viable solution would be to find the precious gold on other celestial bodies. Many space expeditions were made to the planets closest to Nibiru, but the results were dismal, as gold veins were scarce. When hope was almost nil, a massive breakthrough was made. On the third closest planet to the sun, a true paradise had been found. Most of the planet was covered with water, with large portions of land that harbored a huge diversity of animal and plant life. Even more important to the Anunnaki, there were many ores waiting to be exploited, including precious gold. The Anunnaki dubbed the planet Kai, but it was later known as Planet Earth. The Anunnaki chose a region, now known as Mesopotamia, to build a wonderful city called Eridu. After 7 days of hard work, the Anunnaki completed the construction of Eridu. They began the processes of extracting gold, which, after being collected in considerable quantities, was sent to Nibiru. Extracting gold was an arduous and painful process. Therefore, the Anunnaki decided to resort to forced labor. The Anunnaki decided to create a new race of living beings, capable of working and learning. To do this, the Anunnaki used the womb of a female primate that inhabited the forests, and using advanced technology, inseminated her with the Anunnaki's essence. But the results were grotesque, giving rise to terrifying monsters, such as cyclops, gorgons, and two-headed giants. The method of conception had failed. The other alternative was to use the essence of a male primate, and after modifying its DNA, to inseminate it into the womb of an Anunnaki woman. After a few months of waiting, the first baby was born, who was given the name Adamu. Centuries after the birth of Adamu and Eva, humans represented a sizable population in the city of Eridu. The Anunnaki were pleased with the development of the humans, who soon became able to mine gold, build houses, and even plant and harvest crops. As a reward for their efforts, the humans were allowed to frequent the Eden, a sacred garden created by the Anunnaki. The beauty of human women started to attract some Anunnaki, but the relationship between the two races was strictly forbidden.
Okay, that was a lot, and we're not going to be able to cover everything. For example, that excerpt cut off right where the Sitchin Anunnaki theory starts to overlap the much more recognizable Adam and Eve story, as recorded in Genesis.
The story goes on to encompass other tales, like Cain and Abel, Noah's flood, etc.
There are fascinating retcons and other rhetorical moves Sitchin makes related to the Bible proper, but we're going to center our critique on the basics of what was laid out in that clip. Specifically, we will cover the following topics.
Did the Sumerians and other ancient peoples have better information than modern scientists about the solar system's formation?
Is there another planet in the solar system we have yet to discover? And did the ancient Mesopotamians already know about it?
Who are the Anunnaki and the Nephilim?
Did aliens come to Earth? And if so, why?
Do the stories of the Sumerians, Babylonians, and other cultures of ancient Mesopotamia support Sitchin's view of how all this happened?
I'm sure you can guess our answers to these rhetorical questions, but I promise you, the particular way in which Sitchin got all of this wrong is totally fascinating. To explore that, of course, we have to turn back to Dr. Miano. Because Sitchin's whole worldview is predicated on reimagining the tales that ancient Mesopotamians wrote about their gods into stories of the incursions of ancient aliens, we need a little more understanding of how Mesopotamian cultures came up with these gods and their stories in the first place.
various localities had their own gods. And there were just hundreds and hundreds of gods. Sometimes there's even gods of just one town, you know, and then the next town over, they have some other gods. As people came into contact with one another, they began to compare their gods. When you're making gods, everybody's going to have a sun god. Everybody's going to have a moon god. Everyone's going to have a storm god. You know, that god's scary, okay? You're going to have a creator god. These are gods that everyone's going to have because this is the tendency to associate nature with intelligence, right? It's all happening for a reason. We want it to rain. So there must be a force out there that makes it rain. We pray to that force. It makes it rain. So this is how gods are created, right? So anyway, they all have their own local gods, but they're similar to each other. So if I'm in one area, I worship a sun god, and I have a name for that sun god, and then I meet somebody else, a traveler who comes to visit. Oh yeah, I have a sun god too. And you tell stories about your sun gods. Oh yeah, did you hear this one about when the god did this? And they, what about this other one? I got a story about the sun god. And you start merging and combining stories. And before you know it, certain gods become larger than life and everyone worships them. And the stories get spread and they become bigger and more important. Other gods always are local. They never make it big. When we say that different ancient cultures had the same god and they had a lot of the same myths, we shouldn't automatically think that that's because it started in one place and then spread everywhere. It's not really how it happened. Usually, everybody already has gods and they just start influencing each other. But it's complicated because you can't just have one line of descent, right? You can't just say, first it started here, then it went over there, then it went. You can't say that, you know, because everybody's just kind of mixing. We have to look at writings, you know, and art, statuary, things like that, to figure things out. But we're already at a point where that has all happened or has been happening. So tracing origins is almost impossible. But yes, when we have the information that we have in that time period, there's a lot of similarities. We even find similarities between gods in Greece and gods in Mesopotamia. They did have contact. They did trade. So there's going to be some sharing, but also some differences.
Then, of course, after the gods were established, some came to take on an outsized importance to a given people. These eventually became the state gods, meaning that while similar stories about similar gods circulated throughout the whole region, different cultures might emphasize different deities.
About a god like Marduk, okay, who was the storm god, very popular god, but one of the reasons he became so popular is because he was the patron god of the city of Babylon. And when Babylon conquered the whole area of Mesopotamia, creating the first or the old Babylonian Empire under Hammurabi, the god of the capital is going to automatically be the god of the empire. If Hammurabi and his successors are worshiping Marduk as the great god, the one who gave them their empire, right? Then he's going to become sort of the imperial god. And that's how he became popular everywhere. If Babylon had never done that, maybe some other god would have been. And that's what does happen in other times when other empires form and conquer. Then they choose a state god. In Egypt, in the early days, Ra was the state god. He's not just the sun god, but because from Memphis, they branch out and they go out and they unite Egypt, he becomes the god of the state.
However, the good doctor cautions us, it's important to remember that with all of these stories getting mixed up and rearranged with different emphases and local flavors, it's still quite difficult today to say which culture was the origin point for any given tale.
When we talk about stories going from one place to another, I'd mentioned influence and all of that, we're going to see, we read a story over here about the Great Flood or whatever, right? It's in Gilgamesh, it's in the Bible, it's in a lot of different places. They have the story of a flood and someone who makes a boat and saves the animals, all of that. There's lots of similarities. But it's really hard to say the oldest was the first. We have a Sumerian one, sometimes called the Eridu Genesis, and it's the Sumerian flood story. It's fragmentary and we don't have a lot of it, but we see, this is the oldest. But that doesn't necessarily mean, the Sumerians came up with the story, And then everybody else copied. Because you know how it is when people are talking, the stories are going around, people are communicating. All kinds of things are going not only one way, but both ways. There are probably lost versions, you know, many lost versions. And you don't really know who's copying whom or what historical basis it has. Maybe there was a real flood, right? The short answer to all that is, we don't really know. But we do know it's a cultural milieu. We know that everybody was talking about it in this area, and they all had different versions of it. That we know.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.